The Helicaster Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HelicasterJane.com.
I'm blaming my children for a lot of things I feel in this interview, but nobody wants to go to dinner with my children sitting next to you right now. You do not. You just, you know, it is like I walk into a restaurant. There are a couple little sort of mom and pop restaurants near where I live. I walk in there with my 1-year-old and my 3-year-old. It's like I'm walking in with a mesh bag full of vampire bats. The room just looks at me with such disdain, saying, "I can't believe you brought that in here." You know,
we order,
we ask for the check in advance. That's my one pro tip for parents of young children. Is because you want to be able to pull that ripcord immediately when things get out of hand, and they do get out of hand always.
You want to be able to pull that ripcord immediately when things get out of hand. Oh, that Jason Gay. He is truly one of a kind. And today on the Helicaster Jane Show, we are rolling out the holly, decking the halls, slicing up the fruitcake, and bringing you holiday cheer. When joining me at my table is the beloved Wall Street Journal sports columnist and author of Little Victories, Perfect Rules for Imperfect Living, Jason Gay. It's a ho, ho, ho hour, I promise. Thank you so much for joining me. I am your host, Helicaster Jane. But before we begin today, the Helicaster Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by visiting my website at HelicasterJane.com and clicking on the Audible.com icon for your free book. Hey, what's more fun than a free book? And remember, the Helicaster Jane Show is always available online at HelicasterJane.com and a host of venues including Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, the iHeartRadio Network, and at our home base on Blog Talk Radio. Jason Gay is the sports columnist for the Wall Street Journal, and so begins his resume. He goes on to tell us that Gay joined the Wall Street Journal in 2009, writing a several times a week column which shifts regularly from irreverent topics to more serious themes. He has covered events ranging from the Super Bowl and the Olympics to the Masters and the Tour de France. He has received awards from the Society of Professional Journalists, the National Headliner Awards, New York Press Club, and the New York News Publishers Association. But no resume, no matter how well written, can begin to capture the essence of a writer like Jason Gay, even if it includes the fact that Gay lives in Brooklyn with his family and a passive-aggressive cat, or asserts this little bit of information, that he is the MVP of Super Bowl something or other, which, of course, he is not. Called smart, yes, irreverent, quirky, funny, witty, droll, and more, the adjectives are endless. His wit is now brilliantly on display in his new, well-received book, Little Victories, Perfect Rules for Imperfect Living, which his own mom proclaimed to be not bad. Let's talk. Okay, Jason, let me start with a compliment, okay? I'm going to start with a compliment. You are that rare writer who was almost schizophrenic. How do you like that word? A man of letters. Yeah, I'm sure you're going to laugh at this one. A man of letters who appears to fire on a gazillion cylinders at once, who has mastered the art of taking a brain that seems to capture it all at once, seems to be able to delineate all that info and somehow cohesively put it back to us in myriad observations down on paper. So it's sensible and it's humorous and it brilliantly makes its point. So here's my question, long way around, okay? Ready?
Yeah.
When did you discover you were schizophrenic?
First of all, where were you during blurb season? Because that is about as good as it gets for a compliment, a creative notice. You know, I'm going to save that, steal it, print it for the paperback if we get there. I love it. Thank you so much. I mean, I don't mind being called a schizophrenic if that's the definition.
It's a great definition for good writing, I think.
Yeah, and listen, you know, I wish I felt in control of my situation, you know, and I had some sort of grasp of exactly what I was doing creatively or otherwise. The truth is, I have my head down every day. I got little kids running around my house. I have a job. I have this new book. And like everybody, I'm scrambling around for the holidays, and I can barely keep my head above water. So if I'm presenting myself as anything approaching a rational human being, I'll be grateful.
Well, you are. So there you go. But let's start at the beginning. First of all, Jason W. Gay. What the hell is W? I couldn't find it. What is it?
The W is only employed because we're talking through Skype, and I don't usually there are probably a million Jason Gays out there. It's my father's name, Ward. It's my middle name, but I don't use it in my byline or anything like that. It just happens to be in a simple email address and stuff like that.
Okay, well, I like knowing like the little tidbits of one's life. Okay,
I wish it had a cool backstory,
well,
but it's
know.
Just my dad's name.
It's perfect. But let's go to the beginning, because I want to understand this mind of yours. More from your resume. I want to talk about your resume, because your resume is, I think, kind of interesting. It says you were born in Boston.
Yeah.
Grew up in the nearby suburb of Belmont, Mass.
Yeah.
It says
yeah.
that you had a quote-unquote forgettable career in baseball, basketball, cross-country, and tennis.
All true.
Your late dad, Ward Gay, was the boys, what, he was the tennis coach or coach in general?
High school tennis coach at Cambridge Ringe and Latin High School, which is the school he went to as a child. So a lot of roots there.
But you're Jason.
Yeah.
On your uncanny observative skills, let's go back. Let's go to that. You do have this crazy ability to see it all. You do. All at once. So decipher where did that come from? Do you know where? Were you always that observant?
I think that one thing that I can recognize early on in my childhood was that I was, first of all, I was a reader. I loved to read books. I loved to read the newspaper. I had a paper route. I was obsessed with reading biographies of sports heroes and presidents and sea explorers, you know, which I just feel sort of created a kind of creative fertility, maybe. But the truth of it is, Hallie, I had nothing else to go on besides writing. You know, the baseball career was not going to work out. No one was going to send me to Wimbledon to play tennis. I was probably the worst math student in the history of the town of Belmont, Massachusetts. Writing was really the only life skill I possessed. And had I not developed an interest in it, and you know, a writer's life is an observational life, right? We spend our time sort of noticing things and writing it down. Certainly a reporter's career is very observational. So those skills probably, if I do have those skills were probably honed at a relatively early age because, again, there was no fallback plan for me, Hallie. It was write or bust.
You didn't want to be a fireman, a dog catcher, a sports figure, or some other thing. It was writing from the beginning.
There was probably a period in there where I wanted to be a fireman. You know, I have a three-year-old now who is it would like nothing better than to become a fireman. And so it's so hardwired. I can't imagine there wasn't a point in which I wanted to be a fireman for at least a month or two.
Well, I'm glad that wasn't what you ultimately chose. You're a graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So tell me this.
Yeah.
Tell me what skills did you hone in college?
Do you want the real answer or do you want the politically correct answer?
You can give me whichever one feels comfortable to Jason, W. Gay.
I learned how to make a fake ID.
Me too.
That was a skill that I honed in college. I learned how to stay out until 5:30 in the morning.
Uh-huh.
I learned that all kinds of things, strategies you could employ for beer and the cousins of beer. You know, Wisconsin is a wonderful place to go to school. You notice that I haven't mentioned the academics yet. it's a fine collegiate institution, probably would not accept me in this day and age. But I had a good time there. You know, I met the best friends I have. I met, you know, people that I'm still in touch with daily, weekly. And it's a beautiful school, and I would love it if my children had an interest in going there. But I was not a great academic student. I graduated on time, which for Wisconsin is somewhat of an accomplishment. Most people like to take 5 years. I managed to get through it in 4. But the grade point average is not bronze on a wall anywhere there.
You're an artist, aren't you?
You know, I would never use a term so elegant as artist because it doesn't feel that way when you're on deadline, and certainly not, you know, when you're writing about crazy things like the Super Bowl or a boxing match on deadline. But maybe there are rare moments of art. Who knows?
Oh, I think there definitely are more than rare moments. More on that resume of yours. So your reporting career began covering Little League Baseball for the Vineyard Gazette, and Martha's Vineyard, my favorite place in the whole wide world.
Oh, me too.
Oh, boy. But later you would work as a writer and editor for publications including GQ, Rolling Stone, The New York Observer, Boston Phoenix, and Vogue. I kind of like that one the most. So how did you see yourself in those early days? Did you see yourself as a writer? Did you see yourself as an observer, a humorist, a sports authority, a gadfly, maybe all the above? Talk to me.
Well, it was probably a little bit of all of the above, but I saw myself primarily as some really underskilled writer who needed every bit of advice and mentoring I could get. And I got it through going to work at this little small town newspaper in Martha's Vineyard, the Vineyard Gazette. I mean, this was my education, if I'm candid with you. This was the place where I finally knuckled down and studied and paid attention. And I have very good editors and bosses who taught me everything from the ground up. You know, I needed the complete education. I needed to learn how to do the who, what, when, where, and why. I needed to learn how to talk to people. I needed to learn how to write the basics of sentences and news stories and so on. And so I got this amazing complete education, and to do it in a small town newspaper environment. And we could spend this whole, you know, conversation talking about small town newspapers and how integral they are to many communities and how what a shame it is that many of them are dying off. But they're such a vital part of communities, and also to my journalism education were so important because you just learn right at an early age the responsibility that comes with writing about other people and other people's lives, and the responsibility that you have to portray it fairly and accurately, and because you run into everybody. You know, you write about these people, they're not sort of like, you know, apparitions on the internet. These are people that you're going to run into at the supermarket, at the Little League game, if you're going to walk down the street. That kind of environment, I think, is very constructive to learning the basics of reporting, because people will just let you know if you're not doing it the right way.
You learn integrity there, having done it myself too. I get that. I mean,
I think there's real truth to that.
You know, so how did the Wall Street Journal gig get together? How did that come together?
That was super random. Now, truthfully, I wasn't a big journal reader. You heard it here first. I mean, I of course had tremendous respect for what it was and what it represented. I knew that it was this wonderfully classic storied newspaper with an enormous readership. But, you know, I'm not a guy in finance. I didn't have an economic background. I wasn't getting a free subscription with my, you know, CEO job. What happened was about 5 or 6 years ago, they decided that, you know, in an effort to try to grow the audience of the paper a little bit, they were going to start expanding. And one of the areas that they started to expand in was lifestyle, i.e. things like sports. And so they really wanted to create a sports page just like you would find, well, I shouldn't say just like you would find in any other newspaper, but they wanted to hit that note. And on the contrary, what they wanted to do was do a sports page that was unlike any other sports page you would find in another newspaper, a somewhat incongruous, strange-minded, a little bit asymmetrical type of sports page where you'd never see a story quite like it anywhere else. And my job, my first assignment for them really was to write this weekly column and sort of be observational about sports and bring my, you know, strange brain to it. And for whatever reason, you know, we connected with that journal audience and then grew it. And then we do it now 2-3 times a week, sometimes 4 times a week. And, you know, I have to tell you, I've had the honor of working at a lot of places. This has been the best possible job, because there's this just incredible readership out there of people who are engaged and care and will let you know positive, negative, if you're doing things right, if you're doing things wrong. And there's just this reaction and communication that I've never experienced as a writer before. And I just love it.
So here's the thing that's so interesting. You've had a lot of success. I mean, everybody reads Jason. Everybody knows. Well, it's true. Everybody knows you. And here's the thing. I was nosing around. You know, we have a lot of mutual friends. I was asking people, you know, what's this guy really like? I love that. And you have a great reputation, and I'm curious how you stayed so grounded, because the massive kind of success that you've had there, you know, that's done some crazy things to other people, but not to you. Why do you think that is?
I'm incredibly appreciative of your compliments there, and they're real. I am very proud of the stuff that I've been able to do, but I don't see it the same way. I see it as I'm just every day. It's like, what's next? I don't spend too much time dwelling on, oh, that was a good run, or that worked out well, or wow, isn't it amazing that we've done this, this, and this. I wake up every morning in a tiny bit of a cold sweat about what I'm going to do today and what's the next story. And I always feel you're being judged on what's next. That might be a little bit of a mania on my part, and it might be a tiny bit unhealthy, but I think that's probably what keeps me grounded, is just feeling that there's always something you have to do next. And you know as well as I do, in the newspaper business, there's nothing like, and the internet has changed this dynamic slightly because everything lives on the internet forever. But if you sort of grew up in print, when it was strictly a print product, there's nothing quite like the experience of, and we've all had it happen if you're of a certain reporting generation. You go to someone's house and you go in, and it's either the dog cage or the hamster cage or the cat litter box, and you see the newspaper crested over the side of the litter box, and you see your story, and sometimes you see your name in that story that's in the litter box, and you really realize that this is all very fleeting. Like, the news business and what people read is very fleeting. They have very brief memories, and they want to turn the page fast. And, you know, I don't know if people print things out on the internet anymore and line their bird cages with them anymore, but it was very true for a long time that you know, print did not live forever, and you had to move on very quickly.
I mean, not to take the humor rope back, but I will share with you, I knew my marriage was over when my husband used it for a fire.
That's it,
buddy. We're done. Oh, my God.
It's so true,
it is, right?
It's
humbling. It's humbling. It puts it all in perspective, no doubt about it. Let's move on. Let's talk about this terrific book, Little Victories, Perfect Rules for Imperfect Living. At the bottom, it says, not bad.
That's my mom's review.
I know. We're going to talk about that in a minute, too. I mean, it's gotten such amazing reviews. But my inclination is to say that it's the perfect little holiday or Christmas stocking stuffer, because that's what someone else might say. But I'm going to say that this little book of yours is anything but little. It's large on ideas, Jason, and wit and insight, and it is so you. I mean,
thank you.
It's true. How did it come about? Why did you decide this is the one I'm going to do?
I had been writing this column for the journal now at that point, probably about 5 years. And along the way, I had branched out into a little bit of sort of lifestyle column writing. And I'd be writing these things about whether it was the Thanksgiving holidays and the family Thanksgiving touch football game, or rules for surviving the office holiday party, or your hellish, you know, Valentine's Day, or going to the gym and after January 1st. And for whatever reason, those caught on with readers, and they looked forward to them, and they became, for whatever reason, the most, you know, I would say probably one of the more popular things that I was doing. And so there was some discussion I was having with publishers about the idea of a compilation of those, but I felt I didn't really want to just kind of put old material into a book and try to sell that. I just feel most of it's available on the internet. What's the point, really? I wanted to do something totally fresh and new, and that's what the skeleton of this book is. It's a more fully formed life guide for people like myself who can never adhere to life guides. You know, I consider myself at this point in my life a PhD in mistake making and imperfection. And I don't know how you feel, but when I go see those advice books that are in the airport bookstore and I look at them and they tell me I can have a 6-pack abdominal and, you know, 30 days, or I can have the most uncluttered house in the history of houses, I just can't relate to it. You know, I want to write a realistic advice book for people who don't ordinarily read advice books. And that's really at the heart of what Little Victories is. There is this philosophy, the idea of the sort of small, everyday life moment, which we should celebrate and cherish a little bit more. But the truth of it is, the heart of the book is to make you laugh about just how impossible it is to live up to these perfect standards.
I'm going to digress for 1 second.
Sure.
Do you wake up funny?
Would your wife say you're funny?
I need
a cup and a half of coffee to be funny.
Okay. And do you go to bed funny?
It depends on how late. You know, if I can get to bed and I know I'm going to get about 6.5 hours of sleep, because again, my children are so small and they're ramblers at night. I'm in a very good state. If it's a late night, you know, I've been doing a little bit of traveling for the book to talk about it. If I know, you know, I will go anywhere to talk about this book if I don't get woken up by a 1 and a 3-year-old. It's an amazing thing. So I've had these nights in hotels where I get 7 hours of uninterrupted sleep, and I it's like I'm a whole new person, Hallie. Like, it's like, you know, it's a transformation completely.
Love it. Go back to Little Victories. Elaborate on Little Victories. The key to life, or you're just saying that?
You know, we're all familiar with the sort of genre of advice of sort of going for the big life moment. And you know, there's that kind of graduation speech invective that we're so used to of, like, you know, go, you know, carpe diem, you know, seize the day, seize the world, climb Mount Everest, buy your home, have your children, start your family. You know, these big seismic moments that we all, many of us, covet and want and chase. And while all that kind of goal making, I think, is valid and great if that's what you aspire to, you know, you don't want to get blinded to those goals to the point that you sort of miss the everyday joys. And so what Little Victories to me are, you know, just, again, sort of the mildest, most innocuous life accomplishments. For me, it's like getting those kids out the door without either one of them crying, getting those kids out the door without me crying, you know, getting through the airport without curling up into the fetal position on the floor of the TSA, wondering why I have to take off my belt for the fourth time. That kind of little victory is something to be cherished. And so that's part of what this book is about. And then, you know, this very real thing happened in my life with my family and my father, which all of a sudden, you know, what began as this silly book, you know, this book with this silly life message, really took on new meaning and importance to all of us.
You're a philosopher.
Oh, well, listen, I got to work on the beard if I'm going to be a philosopher. You know, my beard game is weak, Hallie.
Oh, well, I don't know. I bet you tried to grow one, it would grow in nice and thick and full. Well, in the subtitle of this, so you too, Perfect Rules for Imperfect Living.
Yeah.
Jason Gay, you're so Jason Gay. Talk to me.
You know, imperfect living, again, you know, I don't want to dump on the advice book community, but, you know, I sometimes will see these folks talking about their books or their, you know, DVDs or their, you know, speeches, their talks, and they're selling an aura of perfection that I just don't recognize in human beings. You know, I got some great advice when I started writing a column from somebody, which was, you know, to always be yourself and be completely true to who you are. And if you do that, you'll always keep your compass. You know, the readers will always be able to connect. You're not putting on airs. You're not putting on an act. You're not claiming to know more than you want. So on the occasions that I've had to write about complicated things, very often I'll be very candid about the fact that, you know, I don't know exactly the answer here. I don't understand this completely. You know, I'm flawed. I'm imperfect. And the weirdest thing about it is that instead of being turned away from that, you know, the audience being like, oh, well, why aren't you an expert? Why aren't you saying you're perfect? Why aren't you saying you have all the answers? people bond to that. You know, they actually recognize it as a human thought and a human feeling. And I've been really surprised and happy to see how much that helps in relationship building. You know, and I watched like things like, you know, presidential debates and, you know, speech making and so on. And I'm always struck by how that message seems to be lost upon, you know, people in public life, how they just have to act at all times that they have every answer to everything. And there's no room for, you know, mistakes or vagaries of any kind. Because I think that most people would recognize that we're all searchers. We're all people who are imperfect. And I just feel like, you know, that's something to put your arms around.
Optimist or pessimist?
Unfailingly optimist. You know, I'm pessimistic about certain things like traffic and the airport. And, you know, I'm the person who has to get to the airport before, like, you know, I want to be there so I can have a 3-course meal, Hallie. I need that much time or I'm going to have a panic attack. So I'm not without my pessimism, but globally, I'm a relentless optimist.
You ever want to do stand-up comedy or sit at a piano in a bar and wax eloquent about things, or ineloquent as it might be, in a room full of drunks while you tickle the ivories? You ever think of alternate
careers? You know, I thought about we've had the opportunity to travel with the book and talk about it in a number of cities, and what's been really wonderful is, besides just meeting people, was able to sort of articulate the book, you know, on stage and in a conversation. And, you know, I've known some people who have done stand-up comedy, and I wouldn't think for a minute that it is something you can just sort of walk into without any kind of preparation. It is an incredibly challenging life skill that I don't for a minute think I possess. But I do like talking about it, and it doesn't freak me out. And you know, again, one of the real pleasures of doing a book like this is just being able to see the people that are, you know, making it all possible and who are reading it and sharing it with friends. And as far as what you were saying about it being a gift, you know, that's the greatest thing you can possibly hear as an author, is that I read this and I wanted to give it to somebody else. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine anything better than that.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. Yeah, let's look at some of the topics in this book that
right.
you address. Okay. And I'm feeling this. It's Monday. I'm feeling stress. Talk to me about stress,
yeah.
Right?
Stress. What an unnecessary but, you know, inevitable feeling, right? I mean, we now know, and to be, you know, fully serious here, we now know that there's actual physical cost to stress, you know, with, in terms of the duress that it puts us on, both in the minute and but also in terms of long-term health damage. And so, you know, it seems to me to be something that you should be actively trying to alleviate, in the same way you would be worried about, you know, if you want to lose a few pounds or you need to get a haircut or you need to do, you know, stress is a part of your person and your body to manage. And yet what we see so often when we're out there in the world, you know, when we're out there, you know, whether it's we're going to the supermarket on a crazy Saturday or we're stuck in traffic, or I'm always using the airport here, but, you know, the airport I feel is in some ways this little, you know, perfect diorama of American life in the moment. You see people, you know, I'm sure very accomplished, good American people losing their mind, you know, actively over the pettiest, smallest things. And that is just, you know, a manifestation of anxieties and stresses. And I would say probably 9 times out of 10, the reason why people are freaking out in these places is probably not the actual reason that they're freaking out at the moment. They're not actually that mad about the fact that they got the wrong sandwich at the sandwich shop. They're just mad about a lot of other stuff. And the sandwich happens to be the wrong sandwich at the wrong time.
So instead of yelling about the sandwich, what should they do?
Hallie, I think they should try the damn sandwich. You know, it could be pretty good. They might surprise themselves, you know? What if it turns out that corned beef sandwich that you thought was going to be a grilled cheese, what if you just go on a great corned beef jag after that and you realize that, you know, this is something that's been missing from your life? Have a little adventure with the sandwich.
Talk to me about marriage, darling. Talk to me about marriage. Please.
Well, you know, I'm still, I don't know, you know, we're 6 years married. So am I a rookie there still, or am I kind of like,
in these
know,
times? No, that's pretty good, right?
Yeah, I feel we're pretty solid there. You know, but we are in chapter one and with the children, they're so little, and other parents who have much older children look at us like we're like in, you know, season one of The Sopranos. They're like, oh, you have no idea. Wait until season 12 rolls around. Oh, it's going to be really crazy then. you know, I wish with marriage there was some perfect fallback philosophy when you had differences of opinion, because the truth of it is that, you know, we're so prone, my wife and I, to, you know, we regress, we have, you know, we get into it, we learn what we're supposed to do, we've read all the articles, we've had all the conversations and the counseling and so on, but, you know, you still make mistakes. And again, sort of go back to the broader issue and the broader thought with little victories is, you know, marriage is a series of compromises. That's something that people have said many, many times. But I also think it's an appreciation of imperfections, you know, to realize that people aren't going to always deliver on your expectations or your timeliness or any kind of things. And I think that sort of understanding is incredibly useful. But that's, you know, that's a useful life skill in almost any kind of relationship.
I always thought that if you could have the sense of humor when you really needed the sense of humor, then you can beat it.
I think there's probably something to that. You know, I can tell you when I mess up,
you don't mess
and I'm
up, Jason,
being a bum of a husband, that there's no joke, there's no sense of humor that can get me out of it. And I can tell you that my wife gets pretty bored of my jokes pretty quickly if I'm on the wrong side of the tracks. So it's not always perfect.
Should we talk about food?
Yeah, sure.
You know, the way to a man's heart remains, even through all of these liberations that we've all had, food, I think.
Yes, yes. Well, I love food. Are you a foodie yourself? Where do you sort of fall on the chain?
Well, I'm definitely love food. I'm also like a crazy woman when it comes to her figure and stuff. So, you know, I'm the discerning eater.
So you're like the, I'll just have a fork of the cake. I don't want the whole thing.
Well, I'll do that Monday through Friday. It may not be that way on the weekend, but then that's why Mondays are always anxiety. hey, but this is about
you. Like you. I feel like I love food. You know, it's something that you can't you know, live in a place like New York and not, you know,
right,
recognize how amazing it is to have. You know, if you want to go have Moroccan food made by Moroccan people, if you want to have Spanish food made by Spanish people, if you want to have food from virtually anywhere in the world, you can find people who, you know, grew up making it in their mother's kitchen. It's a remarkable environment for that kind of thing. I don't think I'm a foodie in that I am not the person you come to tell the great restaurants right now. I don't know what's hot at all. You know, I'm blaming my children for a lot of things I feel in this interview, but nobody wants to go to dinner with my children sitting next to you right now. You do not. You just, you know, it is like I walk into a restaurant. There are a couple little sort of mom and pop restaurants near where I live. I walk in there with my 1-year-old and my 3-year-old. It's like I'm walking in with a mesh bag full of vampire bats. The room just looks at me with such disdain, saying, "I can't believe you brought that in here." You know, when we order, we ask for the check in advance. That's my one pro tip for parents of young children. Is because you want to be able to pull that ripcord immediately when things get out of hand, and they do get out of hand always.
God, listen to you. You know, you used to be cool, right? That's the thing that happens with kids. You will ultimately be cool again, never to them. But, you know, there's that thing in the beginning, before you had children, when you probably were pretty cool. And then you have these babies and, you know, you're at that stage and then it's not, you're not so cool. Let's talk cool for a second. Not like an LL Cool J, but in simply, it's cool to be cool these days. Or is it? I mean, you know, do we need
the whole industry?
Right.
You know, it used to be, right, that cool was something that we projected onto teenagers, you know, James Dean, Brando, you know, these, you know, symbols of youth and vitality. But now there's cool everything. There are cool grandmas and grandpas in commercials. There's cool dad pants, You know, I spent an hour online not long ago going looking for a cool diaper bag online. Okay. Now, let me tell you something. There's no such thing as a cool diaper bag. And you know why? Because it's a diaper bag. Okay. There's nothing cool about walking around with a man purse full of diapers. But there are plenty of people who try to sell you some version of that. And, you know, as exhausting as it was when we were walking out the door in junior high school or high school to try to be as cool as we thought we were, the fact that it now is carried over into adulthood and parenthood and grandparenthood and on and on it goes, is amazing. And I find it kind of useful to step off that treadmill a little bit and just appreciate the fact that you're never going to be as cool as you think you are, because we've all had that occasion, have we not, where, you know, for whatever stroke of luck, we have actually happened upon the cool thing. You know, you, someone you know has gotten you into that cool restaurant, or, you know, some cool friend of yours actually said, this is going to be the cool vacation place, and you go. And to your chagrin, this always happens. To your chagrin, you discover that all the cool people have moved on to the next cool space. Like, the, you thought you would be cool, but no, in fact, you weren't cool on time enough. So it just is like a cat chasing its tail. And I think it's very useful to step away from it now and again.
Now, listen, I'm just stuck in the fact that you were looking for a cool diaper bag.
Real thing. Google cool diaper bag. There are plenty of people who will try to be selling you one.
I'm like, oh my God, oh my God. I want to get serious for a minute, because, you know, you can tell I'm a fan of yours, obviously, and I love your work. And you've had this great career. We've established that, and you have a terrific sense of humor. But, you know, life hasn't always been a bowl of cherries. And I want to bring that up, because I think, you know, in that cool thing that you were just talking about, you know, we tend, because of the celebrity thing that we have in this society that goes along with cool, to think some people's lives are simply perfect and nothing goes wrong.
Yeah.
Well, things go wrong. You had testicular cancer. You were a mere 30 years old. I'm sure that was no fun time.
No, not at all. I mean, it was totally jarring. It was something that, you know, the way that it gets diagnosed, if to be totally candid, is it hurts down there, Hallie. It hurts. It hurts. And your mind races, like, what happened? Did someone kick me down there? Is something, you know, wrong? And so I went to my doctor, and the doctor did exactly the right thing, which is to say, you need to get this checked out by a specialist. And sure enough, you know, here I was in the sweet spot for testicular cancer, and I had it, and I had an operation. They took me from 2-1, Hallie, if you really want to know the brass tacks here. You know, I had some radiation treatment, but by and large, you know, super, super lucky, incredibly grateful to have had great care and great doctors and oncologists and radiologists along the way. I don't feel, you know, if I'm to be candid with you, I don't really, you know, there are people out there who are fighting much deeper battles and harder battles than I did. You know, I was one of the real lucky ones. It's an incredibly survivable diagnosis. They know how to treat it. There's not a lot of experimentation going on. If that's the worst thing that's happened to me health-wise, that I'll take that any day of the week. It was a very, very fortunate how it all rolled out. Now, that's not to say that I didn't learn something from it and get a great appreciation for that at an age when I didn't anticipate spending a lot of time in hospitals. But, I want to really underline that it's, you know, I've known people who have really been in the trenches battling, and my you know, diagnosis and treatment doesn't compare to that.
But I love the fact that you talk about it openly, and I think it's important that we do, and so that's like a good thing. Switch gear. Watch this.
Yeah.
From that to, are we too obsessed with our sports heroes and sports people these days?
Yeah, we are. Of course we are. I see it every day. I mean, this is right. This is my day job, of course, being a sports writer, and so I'm surrounded all the time by the incredible cultural fascination with, you know, our athletes, our high-profile athletes. And it cuts both ways. I think that, you know, athletes, you know, are disconnected from everyday people in a way that they weren't certainly in the earlier days of professional sports, but, you know, as recently as the 60s and the 70s, I mean, athletes were taking, you know, summer jobs and working in the off season and banging nails just to try to get some extra spending money. But on the flip side of it, you know, we have a fan base that is so obsessed. And so, you know, sports now become, every one of them are these 12-month cycles now. There's no real off season. People go crazy about American football in the middle of July. They go nuts about baseball right now because deals are being made. And there's this level of scrutiny and criticism that no generation has ever had to face. And so athletes, you know, get frustrated with that. And I see that. I mean, I think the real force of all this, what drives it all, of course, is money. And the money has never been stronger. It's spectacular. And it's fueled not just by people's interest, but television and the billions that are being poured into live sports coverage. And it just is a extraordinary cultural force. I mean, I would say NFL football is the biggest entertainment vehicle in America right now, right? It dominates the entire cultural conversation, as we saw both positively and negatively in the last couple of years. But the ratings, there's nothing like it in terms of what it can drive in terms of American eyeballs.
I'm a baseball girl myself. And speaking of baseball, story just broke. You know about it? You know,
Pete Rose.
Talk to me. Where are you on that?
Well, yeah, I would like to know, you know, there's been this conversation for a long time that the Major League Baseball has information about Pete Rose that is incredibly damning. But we've never actually been privileged to have all of it. So we don't really know exactly what the full case is against Pete Rose. It's been a little bit draped in vagaries. But what's been harder to reconcile is the idea of sports betting being such a crime against the game. Now, I want to be clear that what Rose is being accused of from the earlier times when he was a player and manager is the idea of betting on or against his own team, and that being crossing a line and certainly crossing a rule in baseball. That's true. But you look at the way that daily fantasy sports, these things like FanDuel and DraftKings have cropped up and gotten very easy partnerships with all the sports, including baseball. I mean, you know, baseball is simultaneously criticizing Pete Rose for continuing to bet on baseball. That was one of the things that came out today, that, you know, the baseball was dissatisfied with the fact that Pete Rose was continuing to bet on baseball. Well, you know, you can maybe understand that, but simultaneously, Major League Baseball is in this sponsor relationship with DraftKings, which is basically tantamount to gambling. And that's a national product, which is available to everybody, almost. It's hard to not see shades or even more than shades of hypocrisy.
I'm so glad you said that. I so agree with you on that one. I just, like, enough, you know, just enough. Okay, let's stay in sports for a minute.
All right.
Is Tiger Woods finished?
You know, this was something.
I loved your piece, by the way.
If you had asked me this 5 years ago, I would have said, are you kidding me? You know, this guy is going to play deep into his 40s. He's, you know, physical in a way that no golfer before him ever has been. Of course, he's going to break Jack Nicklaus's record. Of course, he's going to be remembered as the greatest of all time. And lo and behold, you know, he has been frozen in amber on that major record for such a long period of time.
Now,
he played well 2013, 2014, you know, got himself up into the top of the world rankings, but his body has quit on him. And anybody who has struggled with the kind of chronic issues that he's had, you know, nerve issues, disc issues, you know, these are not things like, even like if he were to break his leg, that would be a much preferable type of injury to the kinds of things that he's having to wrestle with, because it impacts everything.
Yeah. It's kind of a mess, isn't it?
Yeah.
Plus his psychological state seems to have been.
That's the thing, you know, and that's a hard thing to get a grasp on, because we don't live in his brain. But, you know, a lot of people have said, look, they feel that the issues are upstairs. But, you know, he has had nerve surgery and things like that, which, boy, you know, that anyone who's been through it knows what a difficult road that is.
For sure. Serena Williams named Sports Person of the Year. Agree?
Yeah.
You with that?
I mean, there's a funny debate. I don't know if you've seen of whether or not the horse, American Pharoah, got snubbed here.
I think so myself. being
well,
a horsewoman.
Well, American Pharoah was since 1978, so nearly 40 years since the last Triple Crown
right.
winner. And that is a very hard event to do, for sure. But, you know, I'm much more in favor of the idea of Serena Williams, you know, because she is an actual human being. The horse will be fine without the Sportsman of the Year award. You know, she had an incredible year, and she has changed her game, both as, an electrifying talent, but someone who is playing deep into her 30s at a very high level. And she's also a whale of a business person. She owes obviously a great deal of debt to people like Billie Jean King for the kind of earnings that they have now. But, you know, there's never been anybody like Serena Williams before. And I think that this year, you know, would she have been a stronger candidate had she won that U.S. Open instead of losing in the semifinal? Yes, of course. That would have just been the cherry on top. And this would have been a layup choice for a sports person of the year. But, you know, she's in many ways for people, you know, the last couple of years of Serena has been a reappreciation for what she has done and what she means to the game. And she certainly is among the all timers there, if not the best ever.
She's got some body on her. I always wonder, and I shouldn't say this, but I do. I always wonder how anybody could have that amount of muscle. A woman.
Well, I'll tell you something about Serena Williams, and I've seen it up close, is that she works so hard on her game. And she has been somebody who has been out there incredibly committed to, you know, fitness, especially as you get older. You know, the things that used to come easier, you know, they come out harder and harder and harder, and you have to pay much closer attention to things like nutrition and stretching and all that kind of stuff. And she is working with a great coach for the last bunch of years who's helped her immensely with all that stuff. You know, it's hard work. You know, I watched her at the U.S. Open recently, you know, with the most recent U.S. Open, and she was at a match and had a bad round of serving. And here's Serena Williams, the number one tennis player in the world, going out to the practice court and just practicing serves, you know, by herself for 2 hours. It's like this stuff does just not happen because, you know, someone just wakes up and they're good.
You know, it's interesting. What happens to somebody after spending your whole life? I mean, that's a story in and of itself. Focused on just one thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
one day, Tiger Woods, someday Serena, it's over. My gosh. Can you imagine that transition? I can't. No way.
Well, I mean, you know, many, many, many people make that transition with no fanfare whatsoever. I mean, you know, there are a great many college athletes or people who are.
Yeah, but people of that high profile, that's hard to do, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, the flip side of it, of course, is that there's, you know, hopefully at that point, enough of a legacy of accomplishment and some financial protection that they don't have to, like, you know, all of a sudden start sleeping underneath a highway overpass.
No, but I'm thinking in terms of this. I'm thinking in terms of it's all about yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, that would be hard.
I think so. And we've certainly seen many instances of athletes who had a hard time living with it. Once they were away from the game, had a hard time with what happens when they aren't surrounded by applause and yes people and certainly the level of financial support. It's a hard one, you know.
I'm going to switch gears on you again.
Yeah.
I'm going to throw out a word.
Okay.
Here's the word. Poignant. You like that word?
Yeah, it makes it sound very, very
what?
Yeah, it sounds fancy.
It sounds fancy? I don't think it's fancy.
Poignant.
I think I love the word poignant, and there aren't a lot of poignant moments in life, so we don't catch them. Or poignant might even be something that we don't understand when it's happening.
Yeah.
Okay. But Jason, I was really trying to discern what you do so well and why you do it so well. And I think one of your gifts is that you do get poignant. You know how to write poignant. Is that something I'm reading into your work that you don't even see? Or do you get that? Do you understand the power of poignancy?
I understand what you're saying. I try to recognize those moments when I'm, you know, covering them or thinking about them in terms of like a personal memory. It is, I don't want to say tricky ground because, you know, it's always good to have good material, but, you know, you don't want to be emotionally manipulative with material. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. you don't want to get into a circumstance where you're just sort of being mawkish with emotion and making people. I remember a long time ago, I wrote a newspaper story for a great editor that I had who said, I want people to cry once in the story, not twice in the story. You know, you need to ration the emotion here. You need to like dial things down. And I think that, you know, what you describe with poignancy is like, to me, it's noticing those quiet moments and contrast that trigger some sort of emotional reaction. But I think it's also sometimes restraint and not sort of laying it on too thick. For lack of a better way of putting it, not sort of, you know, manipulating people's emotions purposefully, just kind of like, okay, this is the scene, this is the setup, these are the things that happened. I know that they're emotionally charged, but I'm going to let you sort of render your own feeling to it and not tell you how to think.
That's all part of Jason, the writer, and that's what I want to just explore just a tiny bit more. This voice that you have, your voice, call it your muse, if you will. Do you know who it is, number one, or what it is? And are you getting back to that schizophrenia thing where we started at the beginning of this? Are you tapping into the same vein when you write, or whenever you just put the pen to paper, that it's something different, it's a different voice, or is it just always the familiar muse?
You know, I feel like more, you know, the more that I've done the column writing thing, because again, you know, I grew up in news writing and that's not a place where ordinarily you're injecting too much of your personality. You're just kind of hoping to give people an unbiased rendering of what happened, the who, what, when, where, and why. With column writing, of course, it's a little different because you can kind of put yourself into it. You don't have to shy away from telling people exactly what you think. But for me, the best kind of scenario is always just getting excited about stuff, whether it's like excited, like I'm mad about this thing, like it's like bumming me out and I feel it's hypocritical or yada, yada, or I'm so excited because this was an amazing performance or people aren't appreciating it. And here's what else is going on. That kind of like energy, that sort of excitement, I still get. There's no part of me that gets, you know, world weary or jaded about any of it. I still am excited about it. I don't know what's wrong with me. You know, I keep waiting for like that sort of gray cloud to drop where I've seen it all and I'm cynical about it all. And it hasn't happened. I am as goofy excited about things happening as I was when I started with those crazy Little League kids a long time ago.
Seeing that fascinates me, and that I think that's the key to life. By the way, we were just talking off air about, you know, our parents. My mom was almost 94 when she passed, but the one thing that she always had to the very last second was she never lost her enthusiasm. And that's how you have to approach it, because the minute you do, you might as well die.
Well, okay. That's really true. But I also feel like, you know, it's also good to have a little bit of balance in your life in this respect, that I think you can get too crazy about anything in terms of your, you know, professional passions or artistic passions, that you have to have other things. For a lot of people, it's, you know, hobbies or families or travel or just something outside of just what makes you passionate, because you can't let it just you can't let the obsession just turn you so compulsive that you don't have any other parts of your life. And this is a weird thing to say, but like, I feel like getting older and having obligations that were very real outside of just being a reporter was really good for my life as a reporter, because I had to go live in the world in a way that, you know, if you're just a guy running out, getting stories, running back, writing them, covering, you know, you get into this kind of, you know, you're like a crazy fisherman who's just, you know, obsessed, like, you know, Ahab. Whereas if you have other things, it creates some sort of balance and healthiness that I think is useful. So I think getting older and having to sort of juggle and do those other things has been Very constructive for me.
Grounding,
from
maybe.
From a writing standpoint. Yeah.
Grounding. I think that's what you're talking about. You got to stay grounded and all. I think that's probably true. I don't know. I'm obsessive about everything that I do. So if it's a radio show, I'm obsessive. If it's writing a book, I'm just obsessive personality. So you're probably better grounded than I am.
But don't you find, I mean, on the occasion, can you put stuff down at all or no? Do you have to see it through in the moment, and you're just going to be like, you know, you're focused A to Z?
Well, let me share this with you. I can pick up a book, okay? And I don't care how bad it is, I have to take it to the last page.
No kidding. Wow.
That's bad, right?
Yeah.
That's really bad. That's just bad. I know it. Listen, 'tis the season to be jolly and be with family.
Yeah.
Got something for us on that one? Help.
Well, you know, it feels like we're just still recovering from Thanksgiving for many of us. We're still getting over that, which is, you know, can be a fraught holiday for many people, too. Right now we're in a phase where we're trying to make it work with all the relatives and the grandparents and, you know, sort of working a rotation there and making sure no one's feelings get hurt. So there's this whole new layer of the holidays, which is, you know, I haven't even gotten to the shopping part. The whole idea of, like, you know, getting gifts and things for people, you know, that seems easy to me, to the emotional baggage that comes with just picking where you're going to be spending the holidays, because, you know, that right there is a complicated question for me.
Mm. You're going to be spending the holidays with your mom?
I am going to be spending a holidays with my mom and my other mom. My mother-in-law, we're going out to California for a little bit. My mother-in-law grew up in Coronado, California,
nice
next
place.
To San Diego.
Yeah, great. Hotel Coronado.
So we'll be out there.
But I like your mom. I like her review of your book. You mentioned it briefly at the beginning. Not bad. Is she Jewish? I mean, that's such a Jewish mother's statement.
She's a handful.
I
love her very much. And it's been really wonderful to be able to, you know, share the book, you know, for her to be able to share the book. I went back and I read it at my hometown library a couple of weeks ago. And I felt like I was at my mother's book signing, to be honest with you. You know, my mother sort of stole the show. Literally, the town paper, that was the headline, Mother Steals Show at book signing.
Oh, that's sweet.
And so that feels to me like a really nice aspect to all this.
You write about in the book fatherhood, and you're doing the fatherhood thing now, and that you just recently lost your dad. It's life-altering. We talked about that. The end of the book, brilliant. And I'm not going to even talk about it because I want everybody to read this book. So therefore, you need to know, you need to read it. Pick up this book and read just the last part of it. Tender, poignant.
Thank you.
Listen to me, buddy. What did you learn about yourself in the writing of Little Victories, Perfect Rules for Imperfect Living? Number one thing.
This is to love my imperfections, you know, to not be afraid of being fully truthful. I know that's a funny thing for somebody who's in the business of writing truths to say, but I do feel like there is a way that so many of us in public life, or in writing or in journalism, we're either participating in or complicit in a kind of manicuring of truth out there. And when you really get into the reality of what your life is and you really sort of lay it out there, like, this is the person I was at this moment. And, you know, part of it I'm embarrassed by and part of it I'm proud of, but I'm going to leave it for you to decide what you think. Is a scary but really liberating feeling. And I think so in writing this book and in talking about things like what was going on with my father, which, you know, at the time I was writing it was very raw, was very, very agonizing to confront and especially to put onto page. The only guide I had was being myself and being truthful.
I've been speaking with Jason Gay, the Wall Street Journal sports columnist and author of a delightful new book, Little Victories, Perfect Rules for Imperfect Living, by way of Doubleday. For more information on Jason Gay, visit his website at jason-gay.com and visit him on Twitter at Jason Gay.
and make sure you don't miss his columns in the Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Hallie Catcher Kane Show, a production of Resac LLC. Associate producer, Suzanne